Hi everyone. We're going to give additional participants just a few more minutes to join, and then we'll go ahead and get started. Hey everyone, we can go ahead and get started. My name is Sophie Maria, and I'm a consultant with Guidehouse supporting CDC's WinLab initiative. A couple of notes about the webinar before we dive in today. If you're having any technical issues throughout, please feel free to email the WinLab inbox for support at winlab@cdc.gov. If you have questions throughout the session, please insert them into the Q&A function below. We'll do a Q&A session at the very end of the presentations where we will review your questions and do our best to answer. Please note that I've posted the link to live captions in the chat, but be sure to keep both the captions window open if you use it, in addition to the Zoom meeting. Today, we will start by discussing new WinLab resources. We'll go through some introductions, and we'll have a Q&A session at the end where we will review your questions and do our best to answer. Today's session will end with a discussion of upcoming network events. For today's webinar, we will be leaving the chat feature open for your engagement. When you're utilizing the chat box, please keep in mind the appropriate rules of engagement. Feel free to use the chat to connect with others by reacting to what you're hearing, sharing your experiences, and asking questions to fellow participants. If you have a question for the presenters, please use the Q&A function, not the chat box. Additionally, please engage with respect and professionalism. Any inappropriate language, improper conduct, or any form of discrimination may result in removal from the webinar. Please ensure your comments are relevant to the topic, and if a moderator gives you direction regarding chat behavior, please comply accordingly. Lastly, please notify moderators if you experience technical difficulties or observe any disruptive behavior. I'll now turn it over to our WinLab lead, Alicia Branch, to share some of our new and relevant resources. Over to you, Alicia.
Thank you, Sophie. Like Sophie said before I begin, we will discuss three new OneLab resources. The first resource is the Fundamentals of Working Safely with Formaldehyde and Glutaraldehyde, an introductory course on properties of formaldehyde and glutaraldehyde, and the hazards, exposure routes, health effects, control measures, and response procedures for incidents involving these chemicals. You can register for this course using the link in the chat. Next slide, please. The next resource is the Diagnostic Stewardship Toolkit, which was created to help organizations form diagnostic stewardship teams and applying guidance and principles to order proper tests for the right patient at the right time to improve patient outcomes. You can download the toolkit by visiting the link in the chat. And our final resource is the Intro to Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendment, or CLIA, proficiency test. This is a basic level course providing fundamental information about CLIA proficiency testing, including the process, the scoring procedure, and how to refer. You may register this course also using the link in the chat. So next, I'll read to you two disclaimer slides. The first slide is for our external presenters, followed by our PACE disclaimer. Slide decks may contain presentation material from panelists who are not affiliated with CDC. Presentation content from external panelists may not necessarily reflect CDC's official position on the topics covered. Next slide, please. CDC, our planners, and our presenters wish to disclose that they have no financial interests or other relationships with manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters. And I am now excited to introduce three great biosafety professionals. The first is Chris Mangle. Chris Mangle is a senior public health professional with over 20 years of experience leading complex emergency preparedness and response programs, managing personnel, providing scientific guidance to local, state, territorial, and federal agencies. Currently, she serves as Director of the Public Health Preparedness and Response at the Association of Public Health Laboratories, or APHL, where she provides leadership for emergency preparedness, fire risk management, and crisis response to natural disasters, including hurricanes and emerging threats such as Ebola, Zika, and coronaviruses. She has expertise in developing and expanding networks such as the Laboratory Response Network, promoting a culture of innovation and accountability, and advocating for policies and resources to strengthen healthcare and public health systems. Next slide, please. Our next presenter is Erin Bowles. Erin is the Laboratory Network Coordinator for Wisconsin State Public Health Hygiene Communicable Disease Division, where she provides outreach and education to more than 125 laboratories in Wisconsin to ensure a coordinated statewide response to any biological threats of public health importance. Her background in clinical microbiology and expertise in biosafety serve her well as a member of the APHL's Workforce Development Committee, the Synodal Laboratory Outreach and Partnership Subcommittee, and the Synodal Laboratory Training Specialist Interest Group. Some of the committee projects she has contributed to are the revisions of the American Society of Microbiology Synodal Lab Level Clinical Laboratory Guidelines and developing risk assessment training and biosafety tools such as the Clinical Laboratory Preparedness and Response Guide. And our final presenter today is Ms. Shula Escott. Shula is a biosafety, biosecurity, and bioterrorism preparedness trainer. She began training full-time in 1998, first with the National Laboratory Training Network under APHL, and then in the CDC Laboratory Training Branch. She has been semi-retired since 2018 after serving as the biosafety manager at the Massachusetts State Public Health Laboratory for 2.5 years. Shula has over 20 years of experience developing and delivering training in biosafety, biosecurity, and bioterrorism preparedness for clinical and public health laboratories at various regional, national, and international conferences, online, and hands-on workshops. In June 2018, she received the APHL Thomas E. Maxson's Education, Training, and Workforce Development Award. She leads the Public Health Outreach Shared Interest Group at the American Biological Safety Association, better known as ABSA International, and serves on the Training, Tools, and Resource Committee. She led the development of the APHL Clinical Laboratory Preparedness and Response Guide, which is now in revision. And now I'll turn it over to our first presenter for today.
Thank you, Alicia. I will go ahead and share my screen. Hello, everyone. I am Chris Mangle with the Association of Public Health Laboratories, and I'm pleased to be with you today. Our discussion topics will focus around providing a brief background on the Association of Public Health Laboratories, or APHL, I will also briefly describe the laboratory response network and the various components of this network. Additionally, sharing some information about the partners we collaborate with to strengthen laboratory preparedness and response. And lastly, at the end of this session, we will share some key partner resources that may help you with your day-to-day activities within your laboratories. So a little bit about the Association of Public Health Laboratories, or APHL. Our vision is a healthier world through quality laboratory systems. And in this particular mission space, APHL shapes national and global health outcomes by promoting the value and contribution of public health laboratories, while we are also continuously working to improve the public health laboratory system and practices. At APHL, we like to say that we are that sweet spot of that intersection of policy, science, and practice. So, more about APHL. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization with over 1,700 members. And that membership is a combination of institutional members, such as state and local public health laboratories, state environmental and agricultural laboratories, as well as individual representatives from federal agencies and academic institutions. APHL advocates at the national level for critical lab issues and for increased support and resources for our member laboratories. The organization was really founded around training, and we continue to provide training and best practices for our laboratories. And those practices range from hands-on technical work to also laboratory policies and programs. A snapshot of our membership. So this is what the 1,700 members look like. As you can see, it's a combination of institutional and individual members, with the majority of our members come in from state public health laboratories. But we also have members from local public health laboratories, agricultural and environmental laboratories, as I mentioned. One of the unique things about APHL is that we have engaged corporate members, and they play a key role within our organization, working very closely with a number of our APHL programs. And we currently have 134 laboratories across the US that are members of APHL. As in the case of most organizations, we have a strategic map that guides us, and I certainly will not go through the entire strategic map with you, but I will share two key activities here, or two key objectives. One of it is around the use of APHL's elevated voice to really strengthen laboratory coordination and response. And that's something that we have done over the years, but you especially hear that voice during major emergencies. If you think of the COVID pandemic, APHL really was a convener, bringing folks together and helping to coordinate that particular response from the laboratory angle. We also work really closely with our federal partners, and we are playing a key role in supporting those partners with their efforts to strengthen the laboratory system. APHL believes that that system is comprised of many partners, including both private and public laboratories. Transitioning a bit into the Laboratory Response Network, and you'll certainly hear more from Erin and Shula about the LRN. But this network was formed in 1999. APHL was at the table as a founding partner, along with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or the FBI. The initial focus of the Lab Response Network, or the LRN, was on bioterrorism preparedness. And that came into use when you saw the responses to the 2001 anthrax attack. That photo on that upper right really showcases a letter that was sent to a senator's office. And that's when some of the public health laboratories stepped up and really worked closely with federal partners to detect Bacillus anthracis. Since 1999, the LRN has certainly evolved. And many of you that are part of the LRN are aware of this. And the network has evolved beyond bioterrorism preparedness to support preparedness and response to a broad range of threats. And I'll share a little bit more about those responses as well. Today, the mission of the LRN is to provide rapid laboratory response to biological and chemical threats, which inform critical decisions about public health and safety. So, as I mentioned, the LRN has a few components. First, I'll describe the LRN for Biological Threats Preparedness, or the LRNB. And this network is unique in that it provides standardized reagents and protocols to its members. It also allows for electronic data messaging and communications. It's known for providing training and technical assistance. And the network also utilizes quality standards, including a robust approach to biosafety and biosecurity. The LRN also has vast partnerships with both public and private sector. We certainly could not do the work that we do on a daily basis without all of the partners that are involved in the LRN. So, as you can see, the LRNB is organized as a three-tiered pyramid. And at the foundation of this pyramid are sentinel laboratories. Those laboratories are typically hospitals and private clinical laboratories, but it also encompasses some local public health laboratories. These laboratories recognize threats and perform routine diagnostic services. They also rule out common pathogens, and they refer specimens to reference or national laboratories for further testing if needed. And Erin will certainly address a little bit more about that rule out and referral approach. The center tier of that pyramid are reference laboratories, and these laboratories are known for performing confirmatory testing. They are typically your public health, military, environmental, veterinary, and agricultural laboratories, and some water testing laboratories as well. They receive CDC LRNB reagents, protocols, and training, and they're expected to perform these standardized methods, which ensure accurate and reliable results. These particular laboratories typically investigate and/or refer specimens or samples. It really depends on the capability, and there are varying capabilities among the reference level laboratories. The final tier of the pyramid are national laboratories, and these are laboratories typically at the CDC or the Department of Defense. So, for instance, at the Department of Defense, the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, or USAMRIID, would be considered a national laboratory within the LRNB. These laboratories have the highest technical capabilities, and they perform specialized testing, such as strain characterization and bioforensics. And these laboratories also have biosafety level 4 capabilities. They're also known for their development and deployment of laboratory tests. Another component of the LRN, it's the LRN for Chemical Threats, or the LRNC. And this particular network is comprised of state and local public health laboratories, 10 of which form the level 1 tier of this network. And the level 1 laboratories are truly known for being able to provide surge capacity to CDC. Level 1 laboratories also provide 24/7 assistance by testing samples in the event of a large-scale chemical emergency. They maintain adequate staffing and equipment to support high-volume testing with quick turnaround times. And they also maintain testing capabilities for exposure to high-threat chemical agents such as mustard agents, nerve agents, and toxic industrial chemicals. And the level 1 laboratories are expected to maintain all level 2 testing capabilities. And all of these levels have the ability to perform chain of custody as well as sample logistics in that they can package and ship specimen to other laboratories. The level two laboratories maintain testing capabilities for exposures to chemical terrorism agents such as cyanide, toxic metals, and toxic industrial chemicals. And although the level two laboratories test a smaller list of chemical threat agents, the LRNC methods are customizable and can be readily adapted to detect broad classifications of new and emergent threat agents. When we think of the level three laboratories, as I mentioned, they ensure local support with sample logistics, and they also perform training and outreach with local hospitals. All LRNC laboratories have that ability to perform this outreach and training with local hospitals. CDC has also been working with partners to form the LRN for radiological threats. And so this network is still in development. And what they're looking to do here is leverage the existing capabilities for radiochemistry within the state public health laboratory level. They were also looking to coordinate infrastructure and expertise, not duplicate functions for radiological threats preparedness. And they're working to prioritize fill in critical gaps such as workforce development. APHL's Environmental Health Program works really closely with CDC's National Center for Environmental Health to help strengthen radiological and chemical threats preparedness. So, what's our role in the LRN? What does APHL do? As I mentioned, we are a founding member of the network, and we work collaboratively with CDC and other partners to help shape the strategic direction of the network. We also do advocacy on behalf of the network and the member laboratories, and we educate policymakers on the value of this network in preparedness and response. APHL is also at the table with the Public Health Emergency Preparedness Cooperative Agreement. The Public Health Emergency Preparedness, or FEP, Cooperative Agreement provides resources to state, local, and territorial public health laboratories so that they're able to prepare for various threats. APHL also provides extensive operational support for the LRN, and that support ranges. It can be where we're helping to coordinate multi-center evaluation studies. It can be where we're helping to procure things during routine events or during a crisis. APHL also works closely to develop and provide training and other technical assistance. And our organization is heavily involved in helping to strengthen electronic data exchange. Many of you may have attended, or some of you within the public health laboratories and the Department of Defense laboratories will typically attend APHL events. We may convene conferences such as our APHL annual conference or the LRN national meeting, or technical meetings for the Lab Response Network, bringing together all of the members and sharing timely information around science, policy, and practice. APHL also convenes a number of partnership meetings to help strengthen the LRN. In terms of partners in laboratory preparedness and response, there are a number of partners that are involved in the work that we do to strengthen the Lab Response Network. One of those partners is the American Society for Microbiology, and we work closely with ASM to maintain and update what's called a Sentinel Level Clinical Microbiology Laboratory Guidelines. And many of those guidelines are in the process of being reviewed and updated, as I speak. We also work with the College of American Pathologists, or CAP. And the work with CAP is really designed to develop and issue the Laboratory Preparedness Exercise, or the LPX, twice per year. The LPX has really evolved over time where it reflects the updated ASM Sentinel Level Guidelines. And it looks at really how laboratories can rule out and refer threats into this LRN system or structure. We also work with a number of partners, and in 2018, APHL was one of the first organizations to sign on to a Memorandum of Understanding, an MOU, to strengthen diagnostic surge testing capacity for public health emergencies. That network now, that particular MOU now has many partners that have been, that are involved, and we meet monthly where we discuss how the partners can collaborate to strengthen surge testing capacity for various threats. Again, it's not focused on bioterrorism preparedness. It's much broader, looking at emerging public health threats as well. With that, I'm going to go ahead and stop and turn things over to Aaron Bowles, and then I'll be back a little later to share some specific resources. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chris. Hopefully, let's see, you can see my screen and see what I am sharing right now, so.
We can, Erin.
Okay, thank you. So, hello, and I would like to say I'm really thankful to Dr. Branch and to CDC One Lab for asking me to be a part of this panel today. As the coordinator of our Wisconsin Clinical Laboratory Network, which I will hereafter refer to as the WCLN, a primary goal of mine is to provide outreach and training that helps the WCLN members to work safely while they perform the valuable laboratory testing that supports the health of their patients and public health. So during my presentation today, I'm going to be highlighting some situations where it is desired and appropriate for clinical laboratories to contact the LRN reference laboratory. I will share an example of the type of call I most frequently receive from our WCLN laboratories. I'll discuss how we respond as the LRN reference laboratory. And finally, I'm going to talk about some tools that are available to help with an LRN response. So let's get started. While this type of image may be something that comes to mind when I think of something strange, and as a veteran medical laboratory scientist, I know that the clinical laboratory often seems to get very busy when there's a full moon. This image of walking zombies is not the something strange that we are talking about today. So, in providing training to the clinical laboratories in our Wisconsin Clinical Laboratory Network, I often remind laboratories that the laboratory response network isn't just for identification of and potential exposure to possible biothreat agents, which I will hereafter refer to as BT agents. So as Chris already told us, the LRN is a network for response to any and all hazards or threats that may impact the public's health. And so as we enter our winter season, we expect more respiratory and GI illnesses in our communities. But if your emergency department is suddenly inundated far beyond normal expectations with people who are ill enough to seek emergency medical care and who are all displaying the same symptoms, pay attention. Start asking, are there other medical staff that are concerned that something strange and unusual is going on here? Could all of the individuals have recently been at the same event? Is there some common thread that links them together? This could be a situation where a heads-up call to your LRN reference laboratory would be appreciated. As Chris already told us, the primary role of the clinical laboratories in the LRN is to serve as those sentinels that are always on the lookout, alerting public health to possible danger. Another type of occurrence that clinical laboratories may be the first to notice is an increase in the identification of an organism that they rarely see, such as is depicted on this slide. Perhaps one individual in the laboratory makes a comment out loud to coworkers about identifying listeria on 5 different patients in the last week. And then other coworkers start responding that they've also recently identified listeria species. Listeria is not an organism that laboratories frequently identify, so some red flags should go up if you are seeing an increase in this organism within a short period of time. This could be a foodborne outbreak, And since the LRN is for all hazards, making a call to their LRN reference laboratory would be a great next step. Anytime something just feels off, the LRN reference laboratory wants to know, even if it turns out to be nothing. Let the LRN reference laboratory determine whether or not something is going on that they need to respond to. If you don't already have this information readily available, ask your LRN reference laboratory how they prefer to be contacted during normal business hours, and also ask how they can be contacted after hours for emergencies. And what types of situations do they consider to be emergencies that they want to be notified about immediately? The LRN reference lab should have a 24/7 emergency call number they can provide to you for emergency situations. And this information should be kept somewhere in the clinical laboratory where it is readily available, and all staff need to know where it is kept. The most common situation where I receive a call from a clinical laboratory is when they are concerned that they might have a select agent growing on a culture. The call may come directly to me or to our customer service department, or we may receive an after hours page. But when the phone rings, we'll hear, "We have a possible select agent that we can't rule out and we need to send it to you, and maybe there's an exposure." So in our laboratory, we recently developed a list of questions to ask the caller that helps us to respond appropriately and consistently to these types of calls. Depending on who receives the call, the person may just ask the caller for their name and phone number and tell them that someone who can better help them will call them back. Or they may go through the list of questions with the caller. And here are the questions that we ask. What is the specimen source and how old is the culture? What media plates is it growing on? What did the colonies look like? What is the Gram stain result? What testing have you done so far? Did you do any work outside of the biosafety cabinet? What do you know about the patient history? Have you contacted the physician to ask about patient history and to see if the patient's symptoms are consistent with the infection caused by the suspect agent? Do you have someone who is certified in packaging and shipping to package and ship the specimen to us? And do you have any questions about how to package and ship a suspect Category A specimen? When should we expect the specimen? What's the patient's name and date of birth? And do you have any other questions for me? So let me give you a fictionalized example of a typical call. As I was walking back to my desk after a meeting, I heard my phone ringing. I quickly picked up the phone to hear Julie, who is a microbiology supervisor at one of our larger healthcare systems, say, "I think I've got a suspect Brucella species to send to you." I reply, "Julie, tell me what happened." Julie tells me, "Ben just got an identification of Brucella species on our MALDI TOF. The isolate was from a subculture of a positive blood culture bottle. I asked her how old the blood culture was when it went positive. Julie tells me it was more than 24 hours old, but it wasn't a blood culture. It was synovial fluid inoculated into blood culture bottles." She continues on saying, "At 24 hours, the organism was growing slightly on chocolate agar, but it wasn't growing well at all on the blood. Ben thought he would try to get the ID for the doctor by running it on the MALDI TOF. Ben wasn't considering a select agent as a possibility since it was a synovial fluid, even though it wasn't growing well. I asked if Ben had spotted the MALDI TOF plates on the open bench and if other people had been working in the area at the same time. And Julie replied that Ben had been working on the open bench and there had been two others working nearby. And then I asked her what she knew about the patient history. Julie told me that the patient was a 62-year-old man who had come into the ER complaining of knee pain. The ER originally sent him home, but he had returned a couple days later and could barely walk because the pain was so bad. The left knee in particular was very swollen, so they drew up some fluid and sent it to the lab in blood culture bottles. I asked Julie if they had contacted the physician to see if a possible Brucella identification fit with the patient's symptoms. She responded that they had not done that yet, but in looking further into the patient history, she noticed that the patient had recently spent several months in Mexico. So what do all of you in the audience today think? Is this likely to be a case of true brucellosis? Remember that MALDI-TOF is known to misidentify other organisms as select agents and to misidentify actual select agents as non-select agents. And this has all been further complicated by the reclassification of the Ochrobactrum species to become Brucella species. MALDI-TOF doesn't do well identifying Brucella to the correct species. However, if this is a true classical Brucella species causing brucellosis disease, who needs to be notified? And what are the next steps that Julie and I need to take? I'll go into the next steps in a minute, but I did want to stop here to emphasize how important it is to train and regularly remind clinical microbiologists of the specimen sources that they are most likely to identify a BT agent from. These sources are included in the identification of the Sentinel Clinical Laboratory, which states that laboratories are Sentinel clinical laboratories if they perform in-house Gram stains and full culture workup on any of the following specimen types: blood, wound, or deep respiratory specimens. However, those are not the only specimen sources where BT agents can be found. Other sterile fluids inoculated into blood culture bottles, such as synovial fluid in our story, and wounds caused by animal bites, especially cats, are also sources that BT agents may be found in. I also want to remind laboratories of some important clues that they should recognize that may indicate an organism growing on culture is a BT agent. If a blood culture takes longer than 24 hours to grow, if there is no growth or just a slight haze of growth on plated culture media at 24 hours, if there's better growth on chocolate agar than on blood agar, if your Gram stain shows tiny Gram variable coccobacilli, or if the Gram stain shows large boxcar-shaped Gram-positive bacilli, in any of those situations I just mentioned, then you would want to check the patient history. And in the patient history, you're looking for any notes regarding travel or having lived in a country where our suspect BT agent might be endemic, and any note about an insect bite or an animal bite. And finally, any note indicating that maybe a patient works with animals. But don't just stop with looking at the medical history. Take the time, call the physician, and talk about the patient's symptoms and what you are seeing in the laboratory. Having worked with several clinical laboratories who have found bioterrorism agents growing on patient cultures, and knowing that they often miss the clues that they may be working with a BT agent, a new APHL job aid has been developed. And this slide shows the new BioThreat Agent Biosafety Awareness Flowchart that has been developed as a resource for microbiologists to refer to as the reading plates. It will be included in the revisions to the Clinical Laboratory Preparedness and Response Guide that is currently in process. And Shula is going to be talking more about this resource in her presentation. This slide is from a presentation that I gave to our WCLN members during our regional meetings this fall, where we had a Star Wars theme. It's a reminder that while MALDI-TOF has become the workhorse for the identification of organisms in many clinical laboratories, its use is also a large cause of laboratory exposures to BT agents. Now, I would be absolutely thrilled if some Jedi warrior would come and wave a lightsaber to get microbiologists to stop and think about whether or not they may be working with a slow-growing BT agent before they do any testing on MALDI-TOF. But that isn't going to happen. But if this slide makes you stop and think about the specimen source, the rate of growth, and then ask if there's any possibility that the organism you are working with could be a BT agent before running it on the MALDI-TOF, I will be happy. If there is a possibility that you are working with a BT agent, then move into the biosafety cabinet to perform a Gram stain first. Depending on your Gram stain result, you may need to perform some rule-out testing before you choose to spot a poorly growing organism on the open bench for MALDI-TOF identification. Another frequently performed test that has led to laboratory exposures in Sentinel Clinical Laboratories is rapid blood culture identification. As a former clinical laboratory bench microbiologist, I understand that quickly providing information to the clinician that can help them determine how to best treat the patient's illness is critical. And these rapid blood culture tests can provide useful information. However, if possible, you want to perform any rapid testing that is performed directly on the positive blood culture bottle inside the biosafety cabinet. It's especially important to perform any steps that may create aerosols inside the biosafety cabinet. And this slide is just a reminder that when you are working with a suspect bioterrorism agent inside the biosafety cabinet in a biosafety level 2 laboratory, you may want to incorporate some additional biosafety level 3 practices, such as wearing an N95 respirator or a PAPR, wearing eye protection, and wearing a closed front gown that opens in the back. These are also standard practices you may want to follow. I've also listed the common rule-out biochemical tests that laboratories ideally can perform. We understand that it's expensive to keep manual biochemicals on hand and to maintain expertise in manual biochemical testing when this testing is infrequently performed. But minimally, clinical laboratories should maintain the ability to perform catalase and oxidase testing. And performing these tests using the safest test methods, such as utilizing tube catalase testing, is highly recommended. So let's go back to my story. In the story, the patient had symptoms of knee pain and inflammation and a history of extended time spent in Mexico. Now, these facts lead me to a high suspicion that this is likely a case of true classical Brucella species causing brucellosis. It's a little unusual that the Brucella species would grow better on chocolate than on blood agar, but we all know that organisms don't always do what we expect them to do. As the LRN reference laboratory, after concluding my conversation with Julie, I immediately need to share this information with the team of individuals who need to know and who will be involved in the response on the public health side. So while I notify our state epidemiologist, who then may in turn notify local public health, Julie is notifying her hospital infection prevention team, her employee health, and any others, possibly an infectious disease doctor who might comprise her laboratory's occupational health team. It takes a team of partners to respond to an exposure event, and you never want to be putting your team together for the first time during an exposure. So I'm going to ask you, do you know who is on your team? Exposure events also don't only happen on first shift or during the week. They can occur on third or second shift, on holidays or weekends. Do you know who or how to contact the team members? And especially even when they're off work, where's that list of contact information kept? Does everyone know in your laboratory where that's kept? And do all of the members of your team know what their role is going to be in a response? When an event occurs, you'll need to connect and communicate with the partners you've established ahead of time who are part of your team. What method of communication are you going to use? You'll want to look at the big picture and give everyone the opportunity to ask questions. So some type of Zoom or Teams call will work well for getting parties together to share the information that they have. The public health laboratory and state epidemiologist should be prepared to offer guidance, and if necessary, pull in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. You'll want to make sure that you have a plan of action moving forward and then establish who is going to be part of the root cause analysis process to evaluate what happened and determine what changes need to be made to prevent further occurrences of this type. My initial role in the LRN response is to work with the clinical laboratory to help them with any questions they may have regarding getting the specimen correctly packaged and shipped to us for further testing, and then to help them determine whether or not there have been any exposures in their laboratory. So as I work with the clinical laboratory, these are the types of questions that I typically ask to determine if there has been any possible exposure event. APHL has developed a great tool to help with this process, and here are some screenshots of the APHL exposure assessment and monitoring tool. At the top left, you have a snippet of the exposure evaluation tool. It's going to lead you through determining what work was done by whom, as well as where the work was done and what PPE was worn. This is going to provide the information you need to determine if there was an exposure event. And it will also prompt you to identify who else was present at the time and how close they were working to where the exposure occurred so that you can identify additional exposures that occurred. At the bottom, you have a snippet of the follow-up form that you will use if an exposure event is identified. Once you know which individuals were exposed, then you can develop your action plan for follow-up. And the action plan will include who needs treatment, who will be monitoring the treatment, and this tool has information on many specific pathogens to help you determine the appropriate follow-up. I've included the link to the tool on the slide so you can easily access it, and you should also see it in the chat. In addition to the exposure assessment and monitoring tool, there is a separate poster that APHL developed as a companion document called the Exposure Monitoring Guide. It's a fast, easy reference to post in your laboratory showing some common agents. It gives you the disease name, the risks and routes of transmission in the laboratory, the incubation period, and symptoms to watch for that may indicate a laboratory-associated infection. And I've also included the link to the poster on this slide so you can easily access the poster, and you should also see that link in the chat. If in our laboratory we confirm that the organism is a select agent, there are going to be federal select agent program forms that the clinical laboratory must complete and submit to the federal select agent program. So the LRN laboratory can help provide guidance on completing any required forms. The Form 4 must always be completed when a laboratory identifies a select agent, whereas Form 3 is only completed and submitted if it is determined that there have been laboratory exposures. And there are time limits set for when these forms must be submitted. A task that clinical laboratories frequently struggle with and look to their LRN reference laboratory for some help is ensuring that all select agents are destroyed within their laboratory. This includes both the initial patient specimen, all primary culture and subculture media that are growing the isolate. The clinical laboratory then has to make sure that all the organisms are killed before the waste can be taken off-site by a waste management hauler. And this must be done within 7 days of the clinical laboratory receiving confirmation that the organism is indeed a select agent. Now, if the clinical laboratory has the ability to autoclave tubes and plates and blood culture bottles, this is easily done, but many laboratories no longer have autoclaves, or if they do, they're too small to adequately handle the waste that is generated and to kill all the organisms. Clinical laboratories can't just send all the culture material to their LRN reference laboratory to destroy. Any transfer of select agent materials needs approval from the federal select agent program. So there would be another form to complete and submit for that. If a transfer would be approved, everything would have to be packaged and shipped as a known Category A infectious substance, and most commercial couriers won't accept a known select agent specimen for transport. So submitting a request for a transfer is not recommended. If the laboratory doesn't have an autoclave and they don't receive a request or approval, or they don't submit a request and get approval from the select agent program, the only other option that they have is to chemically destroy the agents and the organism. There's a new APH tool that's been developed to provide guidance on how to chemically decontaminate using bleach to kill the select agents growing on culture. And so I have a picture of a portion of the document here on the slide, and Shula will be telling you more about this new tool again in her presentation. Before I turn the microphone over to Shula, though, I do want to take a few more minutes to talk about the importance of performing the root cause analysis after you have an exposure event. Root cause analysis can be likened to digging up weeds. If I have dandelions growing in my yard and just pick off the tops of the dandelions, they will grow back and even larger. I have to dig up the roots of the dandelions to prevent them from growing back. When an exposure event occurs, if you don't try to dig down and get to the root cause of the event, you will likely find yourself having to deal with similar exposure events. Often there's not a single cause that led to the event, but there may be multiple causes and even underlying levels of causes that all led to the exposure event. And the root cause analysis is the method used to identify that underlying cause. Asking why five times is one way to perform a root cause analysis. In the story I told you, the initial answer to why was there an exposure was that an aerosol was created when someone spotted a plate for MALDI-TOF identification on the open bench. If you ask why that was done, you get the answer that Ben was trying to get the clinical results to the patient as quickly as possible so they could be used for patient care. Asking why again, we find another issue. Ben wasn't thinking about the possibility of a bioterrorism agent in the synovial fluid, although joint pain can be a symptom of brucellosis. Asking why again finds that the laboratory doesn't have a policy to do a Gram stain before doing MALDI-TOF either. And finally, asking why one last time, it highlights that even though the organism was a slow grower and growing better on chocolate agar, the patient history was never checked for information that may have indicated the lab was dealing with a slow-growing BT agent. So after you performed that root cause analysis, the last step of the LRN response is to the isolation of a BT agent is to go back and perform a repeat risk assessment and to make any necessary modifications to your mitigation steps to reduce the risk further and prevent any other exposures. In my story, the root cause analysis identified some possible hazards in the laboratory's processes and procedures. It identified that the faster the laboratory can report an organism identification to the clinician, the better it is for patient care. Speed here is everything. In trying to get through large volumes of cultures, people may work on autopilot mode, and they don't really stop and use their critical thinking skills. Because blood cultures and other sterile fluids inoculated into blood culture bottles may contain some high-risk pathogens that cause more serious consequences if someone is exposed to them, we've evaluated that the risk level is high for reoccurrence if nothing has changed. In asking what additional mitigation steps might need to be taken, it was decided to update the procedure to require that all work with sterile fluids inoculated into blood culture bottles be performed in a biosafety cabinet, just as they would with a blood culture. Gram stains must be performed on slow-growing organisms inside the biosafety cabinet before performing MALDI-TOF. And additionally, staff training emphasized why you would need to follow the standard operating procedure and work in the biosafety cabinet. The training will remind people that, you know, when you choose not to follow standard operating procedures, you are putting not only yourself at risk, but you are also putting your colleagues working nearby at risk. And so it's really important for everyone to work together as a team and follow those SOPs. They are there in place for a reason. So with that said, I will turn the microphone over to Shula to continue, and we will all be happy to take your questions after she completes her presentation. Let me stop sharing.
Hi everyone, I'm Shula Escott and I'm an independent biosafety, biosecurity and bioterrorism trainer. And I've worked with Chris and Aaron for many years and really appreciate doing this presentation with the both of them. Both of theirs were excellent. And I also wanna thank OneLab for having us do this. So I'd like to talk to you about the upcoming revision of the Clinical Laboratory Preparedness and Response Guide. And somehow I lost my screen there. All right. So can everyone see my presentation?
Okay. Yes, we can see it.
Great. Okay, so this is the guide currently. And we are in the process of revising it. It's taking us a bit longer than we had hoped originally, but it will be available hopefully in early 2025. So I'm going to go through the changes. And now, of course, it won't. There it goes. Didn't want to move my slides. Okay. So, it's the best guide right now for the Sentinel Clinical Laboratories. It was developed initially back in 2016, and it was a collaboration with CDC and APHL initially, and then APHL took over managing it in 2016. And it's well over 200 pages, and it's an awesome resource. And many, many clinical labs have been using it for many years. And over the years, a lot of things have changed. So we are in the process of trying to make a lot of updates. And we hope that this will continue to assist the public health lab systems in preparing and responding quickly to health threats. So we've reviewed and updated all of the sections of the guide, which there are many, as those of you who are already familiar with it. And these are available currently through your state public health labs. The new guide will be notify everyone when the new guide is available. And again, we will be sending it out to the state public health labs so that they can get it out to everyone in their areas. So one of the big things we've updated, we revamped the introduction to make it clearer and obviously updated. But one of the big things we updated was the biosafety section. And included in that now is the decontamination of select agents isolated in the clinical lab, which is the job aid that Aaron just showed, and I will be showing that, and the biothreat agent awareness flowchart that she also showed. That is new. The decontamination has been updated, but the biothreat one is a brand new job aid. In the biosecurity basics, which is expanded as well, we've added a new biosecurity checklist and a biosecurity risk management worksheet to help people work on how they can manage biosecurity in their clinical labs. Biosecurity is not just something that the select agent labs have to worry about. All labs should be aware of biosecurity because we know that there have already been incidents in the past where microbiology cultures have been taken out of labs and used improperly. And we've also added, updated the regulations that impact the clinical labs as well. The quick reference guide to the specimen collection of the agents, again, has been totally updated to make sure that it works with all of the changes that may have happened over the years with how we should be handling these agents, collecting them and storing them, and then, of course, how they can be safely shipped. We have updated the packaging and shipping section. And that was a huge change. It went from 87 pages down to 20-something pages because now we are only including the really key parts. It's not to be used as a training in itself, but we wanted to make sure that everyone had the key information that they needed and a lot of links to where they can get more information as they need to do that. Also, all of the organisms have been reviewed and updated, and a couple of key changes have been in the Bacillus anthracis. We've added in Bacillus cereus biovar anthracis and included how you can differentiate it from regular Bacillus anthracis, and also in the Brucella species, the formerly Acrobacterium species have now been included in that section. So we've differentiated between the classical Brucella species and the new species of Brucella, which were the Acrobacterium species. Some new sections that we've added because we felt that these were really needed now from clues we got from people asking us questions in the clinical labs to the state public health labs about what they're using and what they need. And so one of the key things we added was a section on training and competency, especially how that works with biosafety. And we've got some charts in there now on how you can incorporate the competency for biosafety right into your regular competencies, which is really important to be able to make sure that people are not just doing their tests correctly, but that they're doing their tests safely as well. We also have MALDI-TOF, a whole section now added on the MALDI-TOF, how it works. And again, describing that it's not perfect, as we've already noted. And we've added a whole section now on prion diseases and a job aid that we created for that. We also have a MALDI-TOF job aid too. So we are really happy with these new sections. So the new updated job aids that we've added, the DECON has been updated. We've added the new biothreat, biosecurity checklist, the biosecurity risk management worksheet, as well as the prion diseases job aid and the MALDI-TOF safety job aid. So this is the decontamination one that Aaron showed partially beginning part. And where we've expanded it a lot is in this middle section here. We've added in about toxin inactivation and how you can determine how many parts per million of chlorine you have to make sure that what you're using will be effective for inactivating, your specimens. We've also added in a section on inactivating the blood culture bottles themselves, since that was an issue, since so many clinical labs don't have autoclaves in order to do that. So we're really pleased with this update. Aaron showed you the new bioterrorism awareness flow chart, and We will be having, this is all in the new format, and when it comes out in the new book, there will be links to this that you'll be able to download it individually and use in your labs as needed. And since she went through this, I don't need to go through it in a lot of detail, but it does cover from where you start with a blood culture or whether you start with wound and lower respiratory cultures, and goes through all the important steps, including reminding you to stop, don't put it on the MALDI if you have any concerns, so that you don't get exposures in your lab. And then, of course, contacting your LRN reference laboratories. The biosecurity checklist is something new. It was based on the biosafety checklist that APHL had developed way back in 2016. And basically, I'm just showing you a couple of pages out of it, but it's basically the same thing, but has been revised to be able to be used for biosecurity so that you can see when you put your biosecurity program in place, whether you've got all the pieces you need. And then to help you put in your biosecurity program, we've also included a biosecurity risk management worksheet, which asks you to go through the steps of assessing what your vulnerabilities might be, analyzing what you already have in place, and determining what you might need to add. And then it goes through pieces such as your physical security and your access controls, personnel management, inventory, transport. So again, this is to help you develop your biosecurity program. We're really pleased with the prion diseases job aid. Literally, this is hot off the presses. We just finished yesterday making a couple of changes to it. We know that this is really important for clinical labs because we've all gotten questions. What do I do if they think somebody has CJD? How do I handle the specimens? Can I test them on my automated systems or not? So this goes through all of those things that the section, the whole prion section, will answer everything in detail. But the job aid includes specimen types and how infective they might be. So as you can see, most of the things that you get in the clinical labs are not going to be very infectious at all. But there is a low chance, very, very low chance, that CSF might have some prions, but it's very low. We really only worry about highly infective things from things like the nervous system, the spinal cord, and stuff. So this even covers histology area as well, so that the pathologists will have some of the information that they need. And it goes through what to do if you've been exposed and how to decontaminate and ship the specimens. And finally, our new MALDI-TOF safety job aid. It has not been put into the nice new format yet, that it will have when we get it in the book. But basically, it goes through your starting points, whether you're out on the open bench, your routine specimens, and what you have to worry about and where you need to worry if you might be getting exposed. So we really want you to be very careful when you are putting samples on your MALDI-TOF. And we know most clinical labs don't do the targets in a biosafety cabinet unless they suspect. So that's really the key, is be very suspicious. Always look at all of the clues, as Erin pointed out, whether it's growing slowly, what the Gram stain looks like. Do not rush. Remember, you're putting yourselves and others at risk when you rush and you don't pay attention. And MALDI, unfortunately, is one of the areas that can give you some problems, not only exposures, but it can also miss ID. So you need to be very aware of what you're handling and why. And I want to acknowledge all the people who have been working really hard on making this update to the book. It's been a huge project for the last few years, and we've had a lot of assistance, obviously, from APHL, and we had some extra helpers along the way helping us with some of the pieces. But the main team is this group here, and they've just been awesome. We've been working really hard to try to get this finished so we can get this out in 2025. So thank you, everyone. And now I will pass it on to Chris Mangle, who will finish off with a summary. Thanks.
Thank you, Shula. I appreciate it. And thank you, Erin. Excellent presentations. What I'd like to share are some of our resources, and I just want to confirm that you are able to see my slides.
We can see your slides.
Thank you, Alicia. So just a few resources. I know a number of them have already been shared in the chat. These resources are things that APHL typically works with other partner organizations to develop and maintain. I've mentioned ASM Sentinel level guidelines. Those are in progress of being updated. They're also available and maintained on the ASM website. We also work closely with CAP, as I mentioned, to maintain and issue the laboratory preparedness exercise. And I really encourage you all to look at subscribing for those exercises. It's a true test of the system. It's not a proficiency test or a survey. So it allows you to have an interaction with your state or local public health laboratory or your designated LRN reference level laboratory. Also, in terms of CDC, ensuring that you're signing up for the LOCS or Laboratory Outreach Communication System calls. They do those monthly, and I find them immensely useful. They have a number of experts that join those calls. Dr. Branch shared some of the OneLab resources at the beginning of this webinar. I definitely encourage you to take a look at those resources and additional resources provided by OneLab Network. And in terms of APHL, so Shula went through a number of changes that we will see in the clinical lab preparedness and response guides. They are additional tools. For instance, there are bench cards, and those bench cards are available on our website. We will update those bench cards as the guidance changes, but those really help laboratorians working at the bench to have that quick reference to specific SOPs. There is also the BioThreat Agents posters that you can download, include your contact information, and share it within your laboratories. Also include public health lab contact information and share with your laboratories. And then there are a number of different training tools that our training and workforce development team put together into a toolbox that's available as well. And we have a ton of biosafety and biosecurity resources, the most recent being an exercise toolkit around biosecurity. I included that link in the chat, but there are lots of other resources on our website that can be helpful for biosafety and biosecurity. And then please don't forget about some of the most valuable resources, the workforce. Please reach out to and contact your public health laboratorians. They are there to assist you where needed. These laboratories are members of the Lab Response Network, and they can provide access to the resources. They can also help address some of your biosafety and biosecurity questions that you may have. Lastly, I encourage you to connect with APHL. We put a number of things in our blog. We have different podcasts, and then we also have Lab Matters. All of these are accessible for free, so I encourage you to take a look at our website at these various communications and publications. And we also have several conferences coming up in 2025. Those conferences are included here. Our infectious disease conference, ID LabCon, will be March 25th through the 27th of next year, and that will be in Pasadena, California. I encourage you to take a look and register for this particular conference. We also have the APHL annual conference in May of 2025 in Portland, Oregon, and then a number of specific conferences on TB, newborn screening, HIV, and STIs as well. With that, I'd like to thank Dr. Branch and her team for inviting APHL to be part of this webinar, and I'll turn it over to Dr. Branch so that we can get into our discussion today. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we'll take a few minutes to answer as many questions as possible. If we do not answer your question today, and you haven't submitted it anonymously, we'll try to get back to you as soon as possible. And if you have a question after today's webinar, please email us at onelab@cdc.gov. So I want to start with some big questions. You talked about this new document, and I'm excited about it because I'm a safety specialist by training also. So when do you anticipate the release date for this document?
Well, we're still in the process of doing some final corrections, and then it has to go to APHL's marketing group that will format it and make it really look nice. So, Chris, what do you think? Sometime mid-spring?
I think that's a reasonable time frame for us to get it out.
So, will they have to be members of APHL to actually access this document?
No, it's all of our resources that we have shared here today. It's accessible for free on the APHL website. No membership is required.
Okay. So I don't know who wants to kind of take this one. How should we train our microbiologists to be alert for possible bioterrorism agents potentially growing on blood, womb, or deep respiratory cold?
I guess I can start with that one. I think just with some of the things that I mentioned in my talk is being aware that those are sources that are more common. And so you look at that specimen source and then looking at the time something takes to grow. Your typical pathogens, you know, grow well within 24 hours, but most of these BT agents are going to take longer. And so just to think about that, I know Gram stains aren't done as frequently as we probably used to do them in the olden days when I was working on the clinical laboratory bench, but take some time, you know, if you have to do the Gram stain, just try and look at that. Look at that patient history. Try and find out a little bit more before you move on and just rush through to the next culture, which is a challenge because there are a lot of cultures that you're looking at having to get through in a given day. So I don't know anything else to add, Shula, with thoughts.
The only thing I was going to add is your LRN lab or your state public health or your county regional public health labs may be offering training in the bioterrorist agent awareness. And there are a lot of tools out there already that tell you what to look for, the clues. And so we, you know, encourage people to do that and to contact those labs for assistance. I'm sure that they'll be glad to put on workshops for you.
With that being said, who in the Sentinel Clinical Laboratory should know how to contact their LRN laboratory?
Everybody in the microbiology lab actually should. What happens is sometimes these events do happen on second and third shift when there's not a supervisor around. So if they just wait and have a manager or the micro supervisor or somebody know how to contact them, things they don't happen as quickly as they should because they'll wait until the supervisor's in. They'll think, I don't want to call them at home. I don't want to tell them I might have made a mistake and have an exposure. And that just all delays the process. So if it's just something that labs are transparent about, if they say, hey, if there's a situation that happens and you want some help, you know, call that public health reference laboratory. They're there to help you and they will be happy to do that. So those numbers should be available for everyone.
And Dr. Branch, I've dropped in the chat a link to the APHL member laboratories. We recognize that contact information changes a lot, and at APHL, we do our best to update the contact information for those public health laboratories. So if for any reason you've got new staff in the clinical laboratories, just take a look at that APHL site, and that's a starting point to reach your state or local public health laboratory.
Thank you for doing that. I'll take quite a bit of time so we can answer quite a few of our questions about. So
One of the questions is this, how long should you hold a sputum no growth plate case of slow growers?
I don't think that you would hold a sputum plate longer than normal. You're going to hold it whatever your normal policy says. If there is a strong suspicion on the clinician's part that there is something that could be potentially there, that they're looking for that type of an agent, hopefully they are contacting the laboratory and letting them know that they might want something held longer. I do remember those kinds of situations coming up very, very rarely in the clinical laboratory where somebody would say, well, we want to screen for this. Can you hold it a little longer? And that really is reliant on that clinician to do that.
Yeah. But Chris, does APHL work with CLFI?
Sorry, I apologize. Yes, APHL does work with CLSI. And so we are part of a number of different groups, and we may look at how we collaborate with them on specific standards. I recall, in fact, working with them on a continuity of operations guidance for hospital laboratories. So we do collaborate with CLSI.
Let me go to see. Can I contact my public health laboratory during the CAP laboratory preparedness exercise?
Absolutely. Actually, there's some. We've worked extensively with CAP to include notification instructions, but that exercise is not a proficiency test, meaning that you're not going to get into trouble with your CLIA requirements. It is just an exercise. So you really want to have an interaction with your state or local public health labs. You should definitely be in touch with them.
And this one is for you also, Chris. Who does a lab contact to correct information that's incorrect on your member website?
If it's an APHL member laboratory, they could contact info@aphl.org. So info@aphl.org, and we'll get that corrected. If it's a clinical laboratory that has incorrect information, you would work that out with your state or local public health labs to update your information.
Thank you. Let's see. So how is APHL addressing the biosecurity needs of laboratories?
So you heard extensively from Shula, where she described some of the work that they're doing for the clinical lab preparedness and response guide to ensure that updated information is included there. We also recently published a toolkit that has information on how you can conduct exercises either in a hospital laboratory or other clinical laboratory, as well as a public health laboratory. So we are providing a number of different tools and how you can strengthen biosecurity. And that's either through specific guidance or the toolkit, for instance, in conducting exercises. One of the things that we encourage laboratories to do is to really look at how you do an exercise, sort of practice a drill, versus sort of having policies in place. It's great to have the policy in place, but then exercise or test that policy.
This is a really good one. Is who can you contact for biosafety resources? Because I know a lot of labs don't have a biosafety professional that, you know, works within the lab or maybe in the facility. Then, so who could they contact if they had any kind of biosafety questions or needed resources?
So, and I'll let Erin weigh in on this as well, but if you go to aphl.org/biosafety, you will see a number of resources that we have available for free there. But I think one of the things we want to do is encourage you to be reaching out to your state and local public health laboratories. If they have not reached out to you, we encourage you to reach out to them. They are a tremendous resource in this space. Erin?
Thanks, Chris. I agree with that. I think the public health laboratories, they typically have somebody that is working with either the more of the biological side of the agents or the chemical side, and there's somebody that they can put you in touch with within their laboratory that can talk to you and is willing to help you with resources and to figure things out in your laboratory. We're fortunate in Wisconsin to have a great network, but I know not every other state has one that's quite as developed as ours. And so if you reach out to them and know that you want to see something like that, that also helps them a lot if you're reaching out to them.
So I'll end this webinar with this Q&A with this one last question. So how can they be notified when the new preparedness guide is available? I know we can actually send it out through One Lab, but if someone is not particularly a member who's joined today, how can they receive the notification?
So we'll do a number of messaging around this. We will work with CDC to actually hopefully get some FaceTime unlocks where we can share that this guide is new and is available. We'll also work through the lab communications network to see if a message can be pushed out via that network, and then working with the various partners to push that information out. And we'll certainly encourage our state and local public health labs to also share it via their forms of communicating with their clinical laboratories as well. Shula, anything else to add on that?
No, that's what I was going to say is it'll go out through APHL to all of these other areas, and like ASM hopefully would put it out on their listserv. ABSA, we can ask them to put it out on their listserv. So we will try to get it out through all the different groups that we can so that everyone will get notified. And through the labs themselves, the public health labs will notify their Sentinel labs.
Given this will also be hosted on the APHL website, if you go back and check periodically, you know, you will find it there too as soon as it's up. So just remember, you can always go back and keep checking and see if it's there. You will find the current version at the least in the meantime. So,
yeah, and we'll definitely do our best. If you join this webinar, we'll do our best that, you know, when it's available, we would send it out to the participants that have joined, as well as make it available to those who have not joined. So I want to thank you all again for a great presentation. And I, of course, I will be reaching out to you in 2025 for anything additional. If you find that you end up in your updates that you actually had to add a new section as things keep evolving, we will definitely have you come back on and do a presentation to make those announcements. So again, I'll say thank you guys for joining. We are offering 1.5 hours of PACE credit for today's webinar. Your PACE certificate is available immediately after our One Lab, this event. You can go to One Lab Reach on My Learning Hub for easy access. To receive your PACE credit after participating in today's session, you have to be logged into your One Lab Reach account. You can visit the link in the chat and use the passcode to complete the evaluation within 2 weeks. You must be logged into your One Lab Reach account to access the assessment. You will also receive an email containing these instructions if you miss it after today's webinar. And speaking of more about biosecurity, we have, I'll briefly tell you about our next One Lab event that's being hosted on January 29th at 12 noon. It is entitled Securing the Future, Exploring the Importance of Biosecurity. So as you notice, biosecurity is becoming a major thing for everyone, clinical public health lab across the board. Additional details about the event will be shared soon, but you can register today using a link posted in the chat. And as a reminder that the slides and audio recording of this event will be posted on our website within the next 2 weeks. And lastly, we encourage you to utilize our One Lab inbox to share your training needs and feedback on One Lab with us. We use your input to select event topics and better understand the community's needs. The One Lab email address is posted in the chat for easy access. And again, I would like to thank our three guests for joining us today, and I want to wish everyone a happy holidays, and we will see you in 2025.